A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking where documentary fans should actually go beyond the obvious streaming names. What platforms exist for discovery? Is there a Rotten Tomatoes equivalent that actually works for the genre? What are the major international festivals, and which production houses consistently deliver quality work? The tension at the heart of this is something I think a lot of people feel. There's more documentary content being made than ever before, but finding the good stuff feels harder, not easier. Netflix docs in particular, as he puts it, feel formulaic. Some are enjoyable, sure, but the recipe for a genuinely good documentary, that balance of entertainment and information, seems increasingly rare in the algorithmic feed.
That formulaic quality isn't accidental. It's a direct consequence of how the platforms measure success. Netflix optimizes for completion rate. Did you finish the episode? Did you start the next one? That metric rewards a very specific kind of storytelling. The mystery box structure, the cliffhanger at minute 42, the slow reveal of information that keeps you hooked but doesn't necessarily inform you. It's the documentary equivalent of empty calories. Tastes good while you're watching, but an hour later you realize you learned almost nothing.
The documentary, as Page Turner. Which, fine, that has its place. But when the algorithm is the curator, everything starts tasting like the same flavor of popcorn.
And this is the crux of the discovery problem. The documentary landscape has fragmented into three distinct layers, and most viewers only see the top one. You've got the streaming giant layer, Netflix, Amazon, Disney+, where volume and watch time drive everything. Then there's the niche platform layer, Canopy, DocuBay, WaterBear, which serve specific audiences with actual curatorial standards. And then there's the festival and production house layer, which is where the craft and editorial integrity live, but which most people don't know how to access. The prompt is essentially asking us to map that hidden ecosystem.
Let's map it. Start with the platforms. Everyone knows CuriosityStream. It's the obvious alternative. Founded by the Discovery Channel guy, solid science and history content. But what's beyond that?
The one I'm most excited about is Canopy. This is a under-discussed gem. It's a streaming platform with over 30,000 films, and it's completely free if you have a library card, and over 4,000 public and academic libraries participate. The catalog is strong on independent documentaries, international cinema, and what I'd call the Criterion Collection adjacent space. They actually have a formal partnership with Criterion and with PBS, so you're getting institutional quality signals baked into the platform. It's not algorithmically driven in the Netflix sense. The curation is human, the catalog is deep, and the barrier to entry is literally just walking into your local library and getting a card.
The library card is doing a lot of work there as a quality filter. If you're the kind of person who bothers to get a library card to watch documentaries, you're probably not looking for The Tinder Swindler Part 2.
It self-selects for an audience that values substance, and that changes what the platform acquires and promotes. Now, Canopy is strong on the academic and art house side, but if you want global documentary coverage, and I mean global, the platform to watch is DocuBay. They launched a few years ago and have built a catalog of over 1,500 documentaries from more than 100 countries. Their pitch is cultural breadth. You want a documentary about Bollywood stunt industry? They've got it. African diaspora cinema? And here's the specific innovation I find fascinating. In January 2026, they launched an AI-powered recommendation engine based on something they call cultural proximity. Instead of just recommending what other people watched, it tries to connect you to documentaries from cultures and regions adjacent to ones you've already shown interest in.
It's algorithmic, but not in the engagement-maximizing way. It's using the tech to broaden taste rather than narrow it.
That's the idea. Whether it works in practice is still an open question, but the intent is right. And then there's WaterBear, which takes a completely different approach. It's a free platform, backed by the UN and various NGOs, focused entirely on climate, sustainability, and social impact documentaries. The catalog is smaller, maybe a few hundred titles, but every single one is mission-aligned. It's essentially a curated channel for people who want documentaries as a tool for understanding specific global challenges. No algorithm, no recommendation engine, just thematic curation.
You've got Canopy for the library card intellectual, DocuBay for the global explorer, WaterBear for the climate-focused activist. Three distinct niches, none of which are trying to be Netflix.
That's the point. The premise that there should be one platform to rule them all is part of the problem. Documentaries aren't a monolith. A frontline investigation and a celebrity biodoc have almost nothing in common except the label, so discovery needs to be fragmented by intent.
Which brings us to the Rotten Tomatoes question. The prompt asks if there's an equivalent aggregator specifically for documentaries, and my instinct is no, and there's a structural reason for that.
There absolutely is. Rotten Tomatoes works reasonably well for narrative films because critics and audiences broadly agree on what makes a movie good: performances, writing, direction, emotional impact. But with documentaries, you get a fundamental split. Critics often judge based on craft, journalistic rigor, formal innovation. Audiences frequently judge based on how compelling the story is, how shocking the revelations are, how entertaining. A documentary can be factually sloppy and critically panned, but still get high audience scores because the subject matter is inherently gripping. The Tinder Swindler is a perfect example, hugely popular, entertaining, but light on systemic analysis. Meanwhile, something like Frederick Wiseman's Ex Libris, which is a 3-hour observational documentary about the New York public library system, is a masterpiece of the form but would bore a casual viewer to tears.
The tomatometer is measuring different things depending on who's doing the measuring, and the gap between critic and audience is wider for docs than for any other genre.
That gap makes a single aggregate score almost meaningless. What you actually want is a system that surfaces documentaries based on what you value. Do you want journalistic rigor? Those are different axes. So the alternatives that have emerged are more community-driven. Letterboxd has a growing documentary community with user-generated lists that are useful. You can follow curators whose taste aligns with yours and get recommendations that way. There's a site called iDocumentary that does curated reviews but has a small user base. And there's an aggregator at documentarydrive.com that pulls from multiple review sources, though it's not as polished as the major aggregators.
The theme here is that documentary discovery is inherently higher effort than movie discovery. There's no shortcut. You have to find your curators, whether they're human or institutional.
I'd argue that's actually a feature, not a bug. The effort is what filters out the noise. If there were a Netflix-style autoplay queue for documentaries, it would just replicate the same homogenization problem at a different layer.
You found a documentary you want to watch, but where did it come from? That's where the festival circuit comes in, and I know you've been tracking this.
The festival circuit is the real engine of the documentary world. It's where films get discovered, funded, and distributed, and there's a clear hierarchy. The biggest in North America is Hot Docs in Toronto. It's the largest documentary festival on the continent, typically screening over 200 films each edition. The 2026 festival just wrapped up, actually, April 30th to May 10th, which was its 33rd edition. They introduced a new strand this year called Climate Futures, which is interesting as a signal of where the industry thinks the energy is. Hot Docs is also very good about accessibility. They run a program called Doc Soup that does monthly screenings in multiple cities and increasingly offers virtual passes.
The most prestigious globally.
IDFA in Amsterdam. The International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam. That's the one. It runs every November and it's where the form gets pushed forward. IDFA is known for championing experimental approaches, hybrid documentary fiction formats, interactive projects. Their 2025 edition screened 278 documentaries from 112 countries, with 42% directed by women. That 42% number is significant. It reflects a deliberate institutional commitment to diversifying whose stories get told and who gets to tell them. IDFA also released a trend report last year noting a 40% increase in hybrid documentary fiction formats, which I think is one of the more exciting developments in the form.
Hybrid documentary fiction. Give me an example of what that actually looks like.
Traditionally, you had a bright line. Documentaries are factual, fiction is invented. Hybrid Word blurs that. You might have a documentary about a historical event where actors reenact scenes based on archival records, but the reenactment is acknowledged as a creative interpretation rather than presented as literal truth. Or you might have a documentary where the filmmaker inserts themselves into the narrative as a character, acknowledging their own subjectivity rather than pretending to be an objective observer. The point is to be honest about the constructed nature of any documentary, rather than hiding it behind a voice of God narration.
It's documentaries becoming more self-aware about their own limitations.
And IDFA has been the primary showcase for that kind of work. Now, beyond IDFA and Hot Docs, the other major festivals to know are Sheffield Doc Fest in the UK. That's in June, and it's the industry hub for commissioning, where broadcasters and streamers come to buy. And CPH Docs in Copenhagen, which runs in March and is known for blending art and activism in interesting ways. And of course, Sundance in January is where commercial documentaries break out. That's where you get the docs that go on to wide distribution deals.
The pipeline is roughly: a documentary premieres at IDFA or Sundance or Hot Docs, gets noticed by distributors and commissioners at Sheffield, and then hopefully lands on a platform where normal humans can actually watch it.
That's the arc. And the good news is that the accessibility has improved dramatically. Most major festivals now offer virtual passes or free online screenings. Hot Docs has the Doc Soup subscription. IDFA has an online archive where many films become available digitally within 6 months of their premiere. CPH Docs has a similar setup. You don't have to fly to Amsterdam to see these films anymore. The barrier is awareness, not access.
Which loops back to the discovery problem. The films exist, they're accessible, but you have to know they exist to go looking for them.
That's where the production houses come in. Festivals are the showcase, but the real engine is the studios and production companies that fund and nurture these projects. If you follow the right production houses, you effectively get a curated feed of quality before anything even reaches a festival.
Who's doing it right?
Let me give you a few that I think are consistently excellent. The New York Times OpDocs is the gold standard for short-form documentary work. These are typically 10 to 25-minute pieces with extremely high journalistic rigor. They're essentially reported essays in video form. The editorial standards of the Times newsroom apply, which means fact-checking, multiple sources, editorial oversight. That's rare in the documentary world. Vox Media's entertainment division, Vox Entertainment, takes a different approach. More explanatory, more visually stylized, but still grounded in research. Their series, like The Future Of, are essentially well-produced video explainers that treat the audience as intelligent.
Then there's Frontline, which has been the gold standard for investigative documentary for, what, 4 decades now?
Since 1983. And they've maintained quality at scale in a way that almost no one else has. A Frontline documentary goes through an editorial process that's closer to long-form journalism than filmmaking. Multiple rounds of fact-checking, legal review, source verification. The pacing is slower than a Netflix doc because they're not optimizing for the cliffhanger. They're optimizing for understanding. Compare something like Frontline's The Facebook Dilemma, which is a two-part investigation into the company's impact on democracy, with Netflix's The Social Dilemma, which covered similar ground but in a more sensationalized, dramatized way. The Frontline version is less immediately gripping but far more informative. You finish it with a genuine understanding of the mechanisms at play, not just a vague sense of unease.
The Social Dilemma is almost a perfect case study of the formula problem. It takes a real complex issue and turns it into a morality play with actors in a control room. Informative in a lasting way?
That's the structural tension at the heart of the whole genre. Entertainment versus information. The Netflix formula has settled firmly on the entertainment side because that's what drives completion rates. The mystery box structure: pose a question at the end of each act, withhold the answer, force the viewer to keep watching. It works brilliantly for keeping eyes on screens, but it often does violence to the subject matter. Complex issues get reduced to simple narratives with heroes and villains. Ambiguity gets flattened. The documentary becomes a story first and a document second.
What's the alternative? What does the recipe for a good documentary actually look like if you're not optimizing for the cliffhanger?
I think the best documentaries use a 3-act structure that's fundamentally different from the Netflix model. Act 1 is the hook, an emotional entry point that makes you care about the subject. That part Netflix actually does well. Act 2 is the context. This is where data, expert interviews, and historical background come in. And this is where most streaming docs fall apart because they're terrified of losing the audience's attention. Act 3 is the payoff. A resolution that respects the complexity of the issue rather than pretending everything ties up neatly. The key difference is that a good documentary treats the audience as intelligent participants. It assumes you're willing to do some cognitive work. It doesn't condescend.
The documentary as conversation rather than lecture.
Or as provocation. There's a concept I've been thinking about. I call it the provocation vector. A good documentary doesn't just inform you, it challenges a specific assumption you hold and replaces it with something more nuanced. The best docs map out in advance which assumptions they're trying to destabilize and build the entire structure around that. It's not enough to present information. You have to identify the prior belief that the information contradicts and make that contradiction felt.
It's not just what you learn, it's what you unlearn.
And that's hard to do in a formula. It requires editorial judgment, patience, and a willingness to let the audience sit with discomfort, none of which are compatible with the autoplay next episode in 5 seconds model.
Let me pull on a specific example. The prompt mentions Fire of Love as a reference point. That's the Sandbox Films documentary about the volcanologists Katia and Maurice Kraft.
Fire of Love is a masterclass in balancing entertainment and information. It's about these two French scientists who were obsessed with volcanoes and ultimately died in a volcanic eruption in 1991. The film is built almost entirely from archival footage they shot themselves, and it's visually spectacular. Lava flows, pyroclastic clouds, the two of them in silver suits standing on the edge of craters. That's the entertainment hook. But it's also a deeply informative film about volcanology, about the science of prediction, about the philosophy of risk. And it's narrated with a kind of poetic restraint that trusts the audience to sit with ambiguity. It doesn't tell you what to feel. It shows you something extraordinary and lets you find your own emotional response.
Sandbox Films is the production house behind it. They're a relatively new outfit focused specifically on scientific documentaries. That's exactly the kind of quality signal you were talking about. If Sandbox Films made it, there's a floor on how bad it can be.
Sandbox is a great example. They're small, they're focused, they have a clear editorial identity. Another one to watch is XTR, which has been experimenting with innovative distribution models. They produced a documentary called The Stroll about trans sex workers in New York, which premiered at Sundance and then went to multiple platforms. XTR is interesting because they're trying to solve the distribution problem directly, rather than just making films and hoping someone buys them.
If I'm a documentary fan who wants to cut through the noise, what's my actual stack? Walk me through the practical toolkit.
Here's what I'd recommend. Primary Discovery Stack, Canopy, plus Letterboxd. Canopy gives you free access to a deep catalog of quality documentaries, and the library card requirement means the curation is already tilted toward substance. Letterboxd gives you human-curated lists and a community of documentary fans who are doing the filtering work for you. Between those two, you can build a personalized discovery pipeline that's resistant to algorithmic homogenization.
For keeping up with what's new and good.
Hot Docs and IDFA both have online screening archives where films become available within 6 months of their premiere. You don't need to attend the festival. You just need to check their websites periodically and see what's been added. CPH Docs has a similar setup. And Sundance films tend to get distribution deals quickly, so those will show up on the major platforms. But knowing they premiered at Sundance is itself a quality signal.
The festival name becomes a heuristic. If it's screened at IDFA, there's a higher probability it's worth your time.
And then for ongoing quality signals, subscribe to the newsletters from production houses with strong editorial identities. The New York Times OP Docs newsletter will tell you when new short docs drop. Sandbox Films announces their projects. Frontline has a schedule. You're essentially building your own curation layer by following the institutions whose judgment you trust.
The meta takeaway here is that the best documentary discovery is still word of mouth. It's finding a dot buddy, joining communities like the documentary's subreddit, following curators on Letterboxd. The tools exist, but they require active engagement. The problem isn't supply. We're drowning in supply. The problem is signal.
That's actually encouraging, because signal is something you can cultivate. It's effort, but it's effort that pays off. Every hour you spend building your discovery infrastructure saves you dozens of hours of watching mediocre documentaries that leave you feeling like you wasted your time.
There's something almost pre-internet about this approach. It's the documentary equivalent of having a friend who works at a video store and knows your taste.
The video store clerk is algorithmic resistance. I love that. And it's not nostalgia, it's a genuine structural insight. Algorithmic recommendation optimizes for the median user. Human curation optimizes for taste. Those are fundamentally different objective functions.
Which brings me to an open question. We've been talking about human-made documentaries, human curation, human taste. But the 2025 IDFA featured something called Synthetic Witness, which was one of the first serious experiments in AI-generated documentary. And I wonder, as generative tools improve, does the definition of documentary itself start to shift? If you can generate convincing archival footage of something that never happened, is that a documentary, or is it something else entirely?
That's the question that kept coming up at IDFA last year. Synthetic Witness used AI to generate footage of historical events based on written descriptions, and the filmmakers were transparent about it. They weren't trying to deceive anyone. But it opens up a whole philosophical can of worms. The documentary form derives its power from the implicit contract with the audience that what you're seeing is real. If that contract breaks down, what's left? Is it just fiction with a different marketing label?
Yet, reenactments have been part of documentary filmmaking for decades. Errol Morris used them extensively. The thin blue line between reenactment and AI generation might be thinner than we think.
The difference, I think, is the fidelity of the illusion. A reenactment with actors in period costume has a built-in uncanny valley. You know it's not real, and that distance creates space for critical reflection. AI-generated footage that's indistinguishable from archival material doesn't give you that distance. It collapses the gap between representation and reality in a way that's new.
The technology forces a kind of epistemological crisis for the genre. If we can't trust our eyes, we have to trust the institution behind the film. Which loops right back to what we've been saying. The production house, the editorial standards, the curatorial layer become the only reliable quality signals.
That's also where the economic pressures get interesting. As streaming platforms consolidate, and we're already seeing this with the bundling of services and the ad tier push, the indie documentary ecosystem may shift toward direct-to-consumer models. We're already seeing early experiments with Substack-funded documentaries and Patreon-backed series. If you can build a direct relationship with an audience that trusts your editorial judgment, you don't need Netflix's distribution machine.
The documentary creator, a solo entrepreneur. High risk, but also high editorial freedom.
Potentially higher reward if you can find your audience. The challenge is discovery again. How does a Patreon-funded documentary find viewers without the algorithmic boost of a major platform? It's the same problem we've been circling the entire episode, just from the creator side.
The ecosystem is simultaneously fragmenting and consolidating. More ways to make documentaries, more ways to watch them, but the pathways between maker and audience are getting more convoluted, not less.
Which is why the toolkit we've been outlining matters. The people who figure out how to navigate this landscape, the ones who build their own curation pipelines, follow the festivals, subscribe to the right production houses, they're going to have access to an extraordinary wealth of documentary work that the passive Netflix viewer will never see. The gap between the informed documentary fan and the casual viewer is widening, and it's not because of access, it's because of curation literacy.
That's the phrase that ties this whole conversation together. It's not enough to have good taste. You have to know how to operationalize it.
That's a skill. It's learnable. And honestly, it's one of the more rewarding investments you can make if you care about nonfiction storytelling. The documentaries are out there. They're better than ever in many ways. You just have to know where to look and who to trust.
To pull this into a concrete summary, because the prompt asks for specific recommendations and we've covered a lot of ground. Discovery platforms, Canopy for the library card crowd, DocuBay for global breadth, WaterBear for climate and social impact, aggregators and community, Letterboxd for human-curated lists, iDocumentary and DocumentaryDrive.com for review aggregation, with the caveat that no single score captures documentary quality, festivals, Hot Docs in Toronto for North American scale, IDFA in Amsterdam for prestige and experimentation, Sheffield for industry connections, CPH, Docs for art meets, Octavism, Sundance for commercial breakouts, production houses, the New York Times OpDocs for journalistic short form, Frontline for investigative depth, Sandbox Films for science, XDR for distribution innovation, Vox Entertainment for explanatory style.
The underlying principle, build your own curation layer. Follow institutions whose judgment you trust. Use festivals as quality heuristics. Find your documentary people, whether that's a friend, a subreddit, or a letterboxed curator. The tools exist. The signal is there. It just requires active engagement rather than passive consumption.
The documentary fan is active participant rather than algorithmic subject. It's more work, but it's also more rewarding. And honestly, given how much time we all spend watching things, spending a little of that time on figuring out what to watch seems like a reasonable trade.
The alternative is letting Netflix decide for you, and we've seen where that leads.
The documentary equivalent of eating at the same chain restaurant in every city you visit. Technically food, but you're missing the point.
The Applebee's of nonfiction storytelling.
Covering the covers. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1938, the British mathematician Alan Turing was studying at Princeton when he proved a theorem about ordinal logics that he never published because Alonzo Church published a similar result first. Turing's unpublished proof sat in his archives for decades. When researchers finally examined it decades later, they discovered his theorem inadvertently provided the mathematical foundation for quantifying the maximum computational speedup possible through parallel processing in distributed systems, a result that would not be independently derived until the 1970s. So a proof abandoned out of academic politeness in the 1930s accidentally solved a problem that nobody would articulate for another 40 years.
A theorem so ahead of its time, it had to wait for the problem to be invented.
Academic politeness as the bottleneck of scientific progress. There's a documentary in that.
There really is. Someone call Sandbox Films. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for the fact and the production. If you've got your own documentary discovery hacks, platforms we missed, festivals you swear by, curators you follow, we want to hear them. Email the show or find us at myweirdprompts.com. We're also on Spotify and Telegram. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go watch something that makes you smarter.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.